The book of the prophet Jonah, chapter 2 and verses 1 to 10, with particular focus on the second half of verse 6, the prayer of Jonah from within the great fish, the mega katos, as the Greek version of the Bible calls it. Verse 6, these words, "But you brought my life up from the pit, O Lord my God." It happened once, actually, just off the Falklands. Ambrose John Wilson catalogued an incident from a journal in 1927. One of the crew of a whaling ship was swallowed by a large sperm whale, which had been harpooned and then had overturned the boat with a flick of its tail. Eventually, the whale was killed and opened up, it not being until the third day that the missing crewman was found inside, curled up in a little ball, unconscious and in a poor way, but still alive. There may be some listening who at some point themselves may have been caught up in perhaps a totally different, but nevertheless mega, experience. Perhaps you're even in one now, somebody here, I don't know who. And when your life is ebbing away, and people say that your life flashes before you, prayer is not far away. Here was Jonah, one of God's prophets from the 8th century BC, commissioned to go and preach to the wicked heathen city of Nineveh. But he recoils from the prospect, and he heads off in the opposite direction, boards a ship, and our story picks up with Jonah as the runaway prophet. When a storm at sea boils up, Jonah detects the hand of God, and in all of the confusion, the superstitious sailors throw Jonah overboard as the alien whose presence was recognized as being the cause of all the trouble. The great fish swallows Jonah, and little by little, the book of Jonah takes on an importance out of all proportion to its four short chapters. So much so that you can get into difficulties with some of the very wordy commentaries that have been produced on this little book. Some commentaries are better than others, of course. Too many of them only make neat, pietistic points out of Jonah chapter 2, for example. One writer has as his main observations when Jonah prayed. Secondly, where Jonah prayed, with the added comment, "No place is amiss for prayer." He goes on to quote from the New Testament, "I would that men prayed everywhere." Well, it's all right, but it's not really on the point very much. One fine commentary is like a long-distance runner. It stretches to 360 pages. Very worthy material, of course, but not the lightest of reading. Just one sentence from it, I observed, went to 147 words. I counted. Most of the commentaries seem to think that Jonah and his prayer was quite excellent, a model for prayer. And certainly it was rather wonderful when you think of it. After all, whose prayers are going to score 10 out of 10 when you have been swallowed by a mega katos? Actually, as a prayer, Jonah's is in fact all about himself. The words "I" or "me" here occur 24 times. You can tell I'm in a counting mood today. In point of fact, what makes the prayer memorable is that much of it is composed out of the psalmody of Israel. When you're in a fix, we know the same phenomenon. On the whole, you don't resort to those hymns and songs that feature in modern worship books. What comes floating into your mind are the songs you learnt when you were in your childhood Sunday school days, or at that summer camp, or whatever it was. The equivalent of the summer camp for Jonah is found in verse 4, where he prays, "I said, I have been banished from your sight, yet I will look again towards your holy temple." And again in verse 7, "When my life was ebbing away, I remembered you, Lord, and my prayer rose to you, to your holy temple." It may not have been the temple at Jerusalem that Jonah was recalling, because he was from the far north. But at any rate, he is back at camp all over again in the Bible class. Those earlier days of blessing are rushing back. And that can happen right now to somebody taking part in this service now at All Souls Church, or maybe listening to the recording of this message. Something's happening in your life. And the old songs, the old memories of better days are acting on you like the sound of London's Bow Bells in the fable of Dick Whittington that seem to be chiming, "Turn again, Whittington." And you find that you are being recalled, summoned to better days as God's word and the songs of God's people here make their insistent appeal upon you. It was certainly like that for Jonah. His life was, as he puts it, ebbing away. He seems to hear singing there in the depths of the Mediterranean Sea. You remember in the darkness what you learnt in the light. The things you learnt when things were going well, those are the things that will stand you in good stead when life folds in on top of you. We look at Jonah chapter 2, verse 3. "You hurled me into the deep, into the very heart of the seas, and the currents swirled about me. All your waves and breakers swept over me." Well, that's Psalm 42, verse 7, that had come back to him. "All your waves and breakers," it records, "have swept over me." And the psalm itself is one of comfort in adversity. Jonah's prayer in verse 5, for example, seems to contain echoes of Psalm 69, verses 1 and 2. "Save me, O God, for the waters have come up to my neck. I sink in the miry depths where there is no foothold. I have come into the deep waters. The floods engulf me." Quite evidently, Jonah, as a man of God, had fed his soul upon the Psalms in earlier times. He'd been exposed to God's revelation in the Scriptures. And this provided a reservoir of hope, a reservoir of theology, for the crisis when it hit. Do you have such a reservoir? If not, let today be day one of building a reservoir, a credible, Bible-based worldview that won't crumble in the face of loss, bereavement, ill health, and the approach of death. Let the Bible help us. Let the church and its programs contribute. Rico Tice, my colleague, puts on every so often a course called Christianity Explored. It's starting again this next month. And when that happens, he will want numbers of us who are inquirers to join it on a Wednesday evening. We can sign up for that today with those yellow cards that we find at the end of the seats or in the Bibles. There's help at hand to help us build an outlook that is going to stand up when everything goes wrong. The main reason for the importance of this little book of Jonah lies in the use, actually, that Jesus made of it in the New Testament. So we have a look at Matthew chapter 12, page 978 in the Bibles here. Matthew 12, for Jonah. And the book of Jonah was part of Christ's reservoir of theology, and it was woven into the teaching he gave to the scribes and the Pharisees of his own day when they demanded a miraculous sign from him. Matthew 12, verse 39, Jesus answered, "A wicked and adulterous generation asks for a miraculous sign, but none will be given it, except the sign of the prophet Jonah. For as Jonah was 3 days and three nights in the belly of a huge fish, so the Son of Man will be 3 days and three nights in the heart of the earth." Interestingly, there is in Matthew 12 this reminder that Jesus had just performed a miracle of healing on a demon-possessed man. It was a sure sign of his true identity, to the extent that the onlookers asked each other, "Could this be the Son of David, the Messiah?" Matthew 12, verse 23. But that wasn't the kind of miraculous sign that the Pharisees wanted. They were wanting a sign to confirm a sign, some sort of token from heaven, given independently of Jesus, to give them final proof that the miraculous power of Jesus really came from God. So Jesus, by referring to the deliverance of Jonah after 3 days and three nights in the belly of the great fish, points to his own impending resurrection after 3 days and three nights in what he calls the heart of the earth. That last phrase finds a parallel in Ephesians chapter 4, verse 9, where the Apostle Paul writes of Christ in his death, I quote, descending to the lower earthly regions. And that, says Jesus, is the only sign that you're going to receive, the sign of the prophet Jonah. Suddenly now, the book of Jonah is seen to possess a Jesus dimension. Ought we at this point just to clear up one matter, the problem about the 3 days and three nights that are common in the ordeal both of Jonah and Jesus? Surely, it's been sometimes argued, if Jesus was crucified on the Friday and the following day was said to be the Sabbath, then he would only have had one full day of 24 hours in the grave and only a part of two additional days. So not 3 days and three nights. Is the Bible wrong? In fact, I was sent a book last year by a man who'd taken ages writing and then publishing a book stating that Jesus must have been crucified on a Wednesday. He could have saved himself the ink and the hours if he just had known one or two facts about how Jewish chronology worked. Because the Jewish way of reckoning a day and a night was that even if you take only one quarter of an hour out of one day, that can stand as a day and a night. Just a bit of a day would count as a day and a night in their counting. So, for example, in the book of Esther, chapter 4, verse 16, where Esther the queen is in danger, and she sees her people in danger, so she's going to go and intercede to the king. She says to her friends, you better engage in a fast for 3 days and three nights, and I won't go to the king until that fast is completed. Then it says in chapter 5, verse 1, on the third day, she went to the king, donned her royal robes. Same thing. That's how Jewish accounting worked. A bit of a day counts as a day and a night, just so that we get that clear. On the Sunday school level, we can read the story of Jonah as an exciting adventure with a great fish. But here in this Old Testament book is yet another instance from these inspired writers of old of hope in the past for the future. There's something of Christ, and indeed of his resurrection, in this prayer of Jonah chapter 2. When Jonah, in his predicament, quotes from Psalm 69, we notice that it's the very psalm where some of its words are applied in the New Testament to Christ. For example, Psalm 69, verse 9, the insults of those who insult you fall on me. And that's directly attributed in Romans chapter 15, verse 3, to Christ, with the added comment that everything that was written in the past was written to teach us, so that through endurance and the encouragement of the scriptures, we might have hope. Hope in the past for the future. That's the principle. Of course, the great sign that Christ, the suffering servant for the whole human race in his death on the cross, was indeed whom he claimed to be, that unmistakable sign was the resurrection. Had Jesus stayed in the grave, there would have been nothing to preach. Had Jonah not emerged from the great fish, there would have been nothing to preach to the wicked people of Nineveh. As it was, there would be no excuse for them. Here was a man who had been swallowed by a great fish, now alive again. The sailors who had thrown him overboard themselves knew what they'd done. They prayed that they would not be held responsible for what they called taking this man's life. They prayed in Jonah 1, verse 14, do not hold us accountable for killing an innocent man. Yes, in their thinking, being thrown into the sea was Jonah's death sentence. He emerges, raised to life again, and so confronts the citizens of Nineveh with such a sign, and therefore such preaching, that as Jonah 3, verse 5 tells us, the Ninevites believed God. And they repent, and they turn unitedly right across the city from the king downwards to God. and his judgment upon them is averted. Or at least, it was averted for 100 years or so. It's only then after that period, after further lapses into godlessness, that Nineveh goes down under a combined assault of Babylonians, Scythians, and Medes in August 612 BC. And then it never rose again. But that's the subject of another Old Testament prophet, the book of Nahum. No, the Ninevites believed under the preaching of Jonah, and that's the other part of the sign of Jonah, the preaching. Back, if you will, to Matthew 12 and on to verse 41, where Jesus rounds on his critics, on those Pharisees and scribes who are demanding a miraculous sign. And he says to them, "The people of Nineveh will stand up at the judgment with this generation and condemn it. For they repented at the preaching of Jonah, and now one greater than Jonah is here." And Jesus continues, "The queen of the south," he's referring to the queen of Sheba in 1 Kings 10, "the queen of the south will rise at the judgment with this generation and condemn it. For she came from the ends of the earth to listen to Solomon's wisdom, and now one greater than Solomon is here," as he was, standing right in front of them. The common people who listened to Jesus responded to his preaching, as the Ninevites responded to Jonah. Not so the leaders in their tight hold on power and privilege. So Jonah, ladies and gentlemen, stands for all time as a model, a type of Jesus. Luke 11, verse 30, quotes Jesus as saying, "For as Jonah was assigned to the Ninevites, so also will the Son of Man be to this generation." The hope in the past for the future. As a matter of fact, would you like the resurrection of Christ to be true? You'd think the answer would be a universal yes, but you'd be wrong. It was in the late 1980s that a Christian bookseller in Southend spent £50,000 so that the postmark, "Jesus is Alive," might be franked at the post office on millions of letters in the coming up to Easter. It provoked an outcry among many people. One letter to the Guardian protested, "It is outrageous of the post office. Those of us who believe that Jesus is dead and have devoted some serious thought to the matter do not wish to be told every day for 6 weeks that he isn't." Other letters contained phrases like "greatly perturbed," "obscene," "most offensive," and so on. It was Bernard Levin of the Times, not a Christian himself, who put it all in perspective when he wrote to the objectors in the Times, "Supposing you are wrong. Oh, surely you don't mind supposing if we all promise not to tell anybody. And that the bloke in Southend who is hooked on the pale Galilean to such an extent that he proposes to shell out 50,000 smackers on promoting him, supposing he is right in his supposition, which started all the trouble, what would be so terrible about it?" Bernard Levin goes on, "I have been asked this question uphill and down dale, and I have never yet had an answer of any kind, let alone one that made sense. I don't expect an answer this time either." There are plenty who don't want to know about it. There are plenty who don't want it to be true. As much as anything else, because they want to live life for themselves without responsibility to anybody else, certainly without responsibility to a higher authority than them. I remember taking a funeral outside London some years ago. I'll change the name of the man, but the widow said to me, "To Fred, life was one jolly good binge." There's a world view for you. Is it credible? Is it going to stand up when all hell breaks loose and things turn upside down? Is it worthy for a citizen of planet Earth? Life, jolly good binge. Some people would like it like that. For believers here, as we look at the book of Jonah, the sign of Jonah that Jesus takes hold of, what does it do to us as we come towards Easter? Why, it elevates our vision and it widens our horizons to take in eternity with the knowledge that in Jesus Christ, because of his birth and supremely because of his death and in virtue of his resurrection and ascension and promise to return, you and I are going to live forever if we belong to him personally. To live in a quality of life unknown here on earth. But that the life of the resurrection starts now. It's already on. We don't have to wait until we die to find out what the resurrection life is like. We're getting a foretaste of it now in the Christian church every day. Not just Sundays, every day. And we should prove that as we go out into a new week and as we head towards Easter. Salvation comes from the Lord is the last word of this chapter 2, this prayer. The word speaks for itself, and this little chapter, the sign of the prophet Jonah, puts confidence, because of the words of Jesus, into the lives of all who are children of Easter, children of the resurrection. That's you and me, if we have made the great start with Jesus Christ. And for others, let this sign of the book of prophet Jonah be like the bow bells of London, summon us and say, turn again, turn again.